I'm Ed Levine. This episode of Special Sauce is being brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company, publisher of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, written by Stella Parks, Serious Eats' very own pastry wizard. In Brave Tart, Stella shares foolproof recipes for classic American desserts. Think sugar cookies, animal crackers, candy bars, and frosted yellow cake. With a historian's rigor and a scientist's curiosity, Stella documents the intriguing stories of how our favorite sweets came to be, and this is key, and the best methods for recreating these classics at home. As someone who has had the not-so-difficult task of tasting many of the treats Stella was developing for her book, I can personally attest to their serious deliciousness. So, if you want to delight your family and friends with homemade versions of the sweets we all grew up with, pick up a copy of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, wherever books are sold. Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of our cultural fabric, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Jiapian, thumbnail slices, little slices of ginger and garlic, marador, horse ears, diagonal slices of scallions, gupaipian, domino slices, niushipian, ox tongue slices of radish.
Today, we are privileged to have an old pal of mine, the woman with the greatest name ever, Fuchsia Dunlop, an English writer and cook who is, in this Serious Eater's opinion, the most important and influential authority on Chinese food that we have, who is, well, not Chinese. Here to talk about all things Chinese food related, the amazing Fuchsia Dunlop. Welcome to Special Sauce, Fuchsia.
Hi, Ed.
I have seen Fuchsia Dunlop order in a Chinese restaurant. It's one of the greatest things ever because they're just like in shock when you're perfectly fluent and then everyone from the who works in the restaurant comes out and it's like, who is this woman, this tall English woman, and she's speaking perfect Chinese. It's awesome. Anyway, so first things first, you do have the greatest name of anyone I know in the food world. Do you have siblings named Chartreuse and Magenta? That's my only question.
Well, their names are not bad. I've got a sister called Leonie, and my brother is called Merlin. So my parents definitely had a thing about strange names.
Leonie, Merlin, and Fuchsia. That's so great. Tell us about what life was like at the Dunlop family table growing up.
Well, I guess it was quite unusual for 1970s England in that it was very, very international. So I grew up in Oxford, England, but my mother was a teacher of English as a foreign language. And so we usually had one or more of her students living with us as lodgers and helping with my sister and me when we were very small. So we had a Japanese girl, we had a Turkish boy, we had Spaniards, Italians actually living as members of the family. And then my mother's students would come over and cook great dinners from their home countries. So we had, you know, the Japanese one evening, we had Libyans, Iranians. So, and they would sort of leave recipes that worked their way into the family repertoire. So it was quite international food-wise.
Wow, you did not grow up in a typical British household.
No, toad in the hole, you know, roast chicken. It wasn't, it was more like sort of curries and kofta and jajuk and things.
And did you take to cooking and tasks in the kitchen right away, even as a little kid?
Yeah, I mean, I've loved cooking for as long as I can remember and eating. And I did help my mother from a very young age. And it always just excited me. I mean, I just love the creativity of it.
You never were put off by the monotony of shelling beans or anything like that?
No, well, that kind of thing. I mean, it's lovely, you know, sitting on a step, shelling peas and thinking, you know, or having a chat. I always enjoyed those kind of tasks.
And what about your dad?
Oh, he's a good cook as well, but he would go for the more sort of wacky, adventurous things like using food dyes to make sort of coloured scrambled eggs or, you know, stuffing a pigeon into a chicken, into a goose.
So you mean, was he like a molecular gastronomist before there were such things?
Yeah, maybe. He's still like that, actually. He sort of likes designing architectural cakes and pastries and drives my mother mad by doing them at sort of Christmas when things are really busy. He'll do some extraordinary engineering food project.
So you were really born into the life you're leading.
Yeah, well, my mother was a very strong influence, and she's a great cook, and she was always very adventurous and always learning recipes from all these foreign friends. And I remember as a very small child, you know, watching my mother tasting something new and sort of guessing how it was made and what went into it. And I remember thinking, I want to be able to do that.
But you never thought you could be a chef or a cook for a living, right? I imagine that was sort of frowned upon.
I mean, I guess I grew up in Oxford, very academic, you know, went to very good schools. And so the wider environment was very much all about going to university and so on. But I remember when I was 11, I remember very clearly telling a middle school teacher that I wanted to be a chef when I grew up. And he laughed at me. But my parents were very open. I mean, I don't think
I just laughed at you, by the way.
I mean, I think my parents didn't mind what any of us did, so they would have been happy for me to be a chef. But, you know, I went to this very academic school, so...
Right, and then you ended up at Cambridge, where you didn't study culinary arts.
No, English literature. But all through Cambridge, I mean, I was cooking elaborate dinner parties, and I was sort of probably more interested in cooking than I was in studying English literature even then.
But then when you graduated, you didn't think to yourself, okay, I'm going to just follow my heart and go into the kitchen.
No, I mean, I wanted to do something to do with food, and I was quite interested in food policy and the environmental aspects of food. But my immediate problem was that I owed my parents loads of money, and I needed to sort of pay them back. And so I got one job, and then I got another job, and then I got this sort of temporary job for a bit of the BBC where I was sub-editing all this fairly obscure stuff about the Asia-Pacific region. I was just put on the Asia-Pacific desk.
Just by blind luck.
Yeah, yeah. And so while I was there, I sort of got a bit interested in China. And
what attracted you to China?
I think it was just this sort of, you know, at that time, a country that was very obscure to most Westerners, which had this sort of extraordinary, tumultuous 20th century history. And I just got interested. I mean, no particular reason. But I went off on backpacking there for a month after a few months in this job and just loved it. Was completely fascinated. So I came back to London and enrolled in Mandarin evening classes once a week. And that's really how it started. And I sort of began to meet, there was at that time, you know, being interested in China was a fairly eccentric thing at that point. But I got to know a few other people into China, and I worked as a volunteer on a China magazine called China Now. And then I applied for a scholarship to go and study there for a year, and that's what really changed my life.
Wow. So you went over there for a year. Like, what did you encounter? What do you remember your initial thoughts being?
Oh, well, I remember arriving in Beijing jet-lagged and... one evening, just bursting into tears and thinking, what have I done? You know, I've left my friends, my job, I've left that house I was sharing in London, all these things. Didn't know what I was doing. But I went to Sichuan University, which I have to admit I had chosen partly because of the gastronomic reputation of Sichuan, although I came up with very sound academic reasons when applying for the scholarship.
Of course. You gotta keep the parents at bay.
Yeah. And then, so I arrived in Chengdu, the capital of Sichuan province, at this university with a few other foreign students. And I guess at first I didn't really know what I was doing. I was supposed to be doing some academic research, but my Chinese wasn't really good enough at that stage to read journals and things. So I was sort of a bit at sea. But anyway, I started just doing what I've always done, which is being curious about the food. And I started sort of getting very interested in these fantastic little restaurants and snack shops around the university. And I started asking the owners if I could go into the kitchen and study. And usually they said yes.
So their reaction was encouraging and welcoming?
Incredibly. I think at that time, you know, China was just beginning to open up. There were very few foreigners. And so we were extremely interesting to local people. There was a kind of novelty value in just having a conversation with a foreigner. And people were also very curious that a university student would be interested in going into a kitchen, because in China, traditionally, you know, kitchens are rough places to work and they're not where cultured people go to work. So,
and probably not where very, very many women work.
No, not at all. Women on cold dishes are making the sort of salad-y things, but what cookery not? So I started doing that for fun. And then a German friend and I heard about this famous provincial cooking school, the Sichuan Institute of Higher Cuisine. And we just cycled over there one day and basically just asked the head of the school if they would teach us how to cook. And
you know, that's just not something everyone would do.
No, it's in retrospect slightly insane.
Yes,
you know.
I was going to say, but I didn't. I was trying to be polite. It's insane.
Yeah. But then, you know, China at that period was a bit insane because things were changing so fast. And, you know, the old rules were shifting. Suddenly the country was more open. Suddenly there were foreigners and people were allowed to be friendly to foreigners, you know. And so there was this sort of atmosphere of sort of mutual curiosity and getting to know the other side, which was very interesting. And anyway, so the cooking school, after a long, long discussion and many cups of tea, lots of haggling, they agreed to give us a few private classes over a month or so. And so Volker, this German friend, and I went and had these private classes, and we had a translator for the culinary terms, and there were people washing the dishes for us and things. So we were treated sort of like aristocrats of the cooking school world. Anyway, and then much later, when I finished at the university, when my scholarship ran out, I really didn't want to go home because I was totally in love with Chengdu by this stage. And I went to see my old teachers at the cooking school and thought maybe I could drop in from time to time for a demo. And they said, oh, we've got a chef's training course just starting. Why don't you join in? And so
you were like, just said, how did I just arrive at this amazing place?
Yeah. So I said yes. And they signed me up and they gave me a cleaver and they gave me some chef's whites. And that was it. And then I just joined in this class of 50 young Sichuanese men, two women, and went to class every day in Sichuan dialect.
And you're, first of all, you were the first non-Chinese person that ever went to that cooking school, right?
Yes.
And talk about the dialect issues that you ran into all the time in China, right? Because it's a complex enough language, no matter what dialect you're speaking. And then you add the additional complexities of the dialect changes. It makes your head spin.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess like most students of Chinese, I'd learned Mandarin, and that's what I learned in the classroom. But having been in Chengdu for a year, I was used to people speaking Sichuanese dialect. So there are some terms and phrases and a very strong accent. So I was a bit relaxed about that. But the most challenging thing was that Chinese cuisine, it's very sophisticated. There's this whole complex vocabulary. So I suddenly had to learn all these words for different cooking methods, for different ingredients. And these, of course, I had not learned in school.
So give us some terms.
Well, for example, there's one cooking term, liu, which is it's a cooking method that is a bit difficult to describe in English. So it's when you have a main ingredient, you clothe it in a sort of starch paste, and then you usually deep fry it, either in hot oil or cooler oil for a slippery finish. And then you drain off the oil, and then you make a sauce in your wok, and you combine it with the ingredient. So quite a complex thing. And there's one character in Chinese that sums that method up.
Really?
No straightforward English translation. Yeah. And then there were different shapes that you could cut food into.
So give me an example of a couple of shapes and what they're called.
Oh, so mi li, which was little rice grains, like cutting ginger and garlic very fine. Jia pian, thumbnail slices, little slices of ginger and garlic. Ma er duo, horse ears, diagonal slices of scallions. Gu pai pian, domino slices. Niu shi pian, ox tongue slices of radish.
And these were all terms that you'd never heard before.
No. I mean, you know, one or two in my experiences in restaurant kitchens, but no, very specialized professional vocabulary.
And was that daunting? Was it terrifying?
Well, not terrifying. I mean, I was, you know, very young, a bit crazy, but I loved cooking. And of course, if you're going to learn a sort of very difficult language, then in the kitchen is the best way to do it because there's a practical element. So you're kind of learning as you do things. And also because I really, really wanted to learn how to cook Sichuanese food. So I had this incentive far more than I had for sort of learning more academic Chinese. And yeah, so and my classmates, though, a lot of them had never met a foreigner China before, most of them, I would say, and some of them were a bit shy and awkward with me, and they just called me La Wai, foreigner. But there were a couple who were really sweet to me and who would help me out with writing characters in my notebook when I didn't catch something, or lending me their notes and things. So it was great fun.
Why did you fall in love with Chengdu? A follow-up question to that would be, what did you love about Sichuan food?
Chengdu is just such a charming city, and people there are very relaxed and funny. I mean, the Sichuanese are famous in China for being tremendously laid back and for spending their whole lives sort of gossiping in tea houses and playing mahjong and, of course, enjoying life, enjoying food and drink. So it was very seductive in that way. And also, Chengdu in the mid-90s when I was there was this fascinating old city, and there were all these sort of labyrinths of old lanes, which really looked like almost like those pictures of China 800 years ago with the sort of old two-story shop fronts and the street vendors with their bamboo shoulder poles and baskets of tofu and little dishes and things. And there were tea houses and duck roasters, and it was just enchanting. And I think also there was the sort of the excitement of being one of a very small number of foreigners in this fascinating country that had been quite closed, really, for decades. So there was this thrill of discovery, you know, going out traveling in Tibetan areas that where there was no tourism at all. It was just completely fascinating.
I assume those places looked like time had not changed them in the slightest.
Some things were run down because of, you know, China had been quite poor, and, you know, after the Cultural Revolution, there had been destruction of some of the heritage. But there were some things that really hadn't changed for a long time, like the tea houses and, you know, people using an abacus to calculate your shopping in the market.
That's amazing.
And the medicine shops with their drawers of herbs, all these things. It was very interesting.
What attracted you to Sichuanese food? I assume you were attracted by the ingredients, the complexity. What about it?
Well, I suppose, the first time I had really Sichuanese food was the year before I went there to study in 1993. And I went on a trip around China and to Tibet, and I flew out through Chengdu. And I had a Sichuanese acquaintance, a musician, who I looked up. And he and his wife took me out for a couple of days. And we just had food that was better than any Chinese food I'd had before. I'd had, you know, your basic sort of Anglo-Cantonese takeout type food. And here was this stunningly fresh, excitingly flavored cuisine with all these ingredients. And it was just thrilling. And I just, on that trip, those couple of days in Chengdu, on the last day, I sat with this musician and his wife at a tea house by the river. And I was drinking my jasmine tea and just thought, I'm going to come back to this place. You know, I kind of made that decision then. And, you know, Sichuanese food is just so exciting. And it was just this whole cuisine, which at the time, you know, maybe Western sort of foodie people might have heard of it, but there wasn't really any available in restaurants. And it was just, you know, a province the size of France with this incredibly complex cuisine that people in the West really didn't know very much about. But it was partly like, you know, I know probably it looks now as if I had this tremendous career idea and I was, you know, had a career path ahead, but I didn't. I was just having fun and loving cooking.
I can relate to that. I've always just had fun and loved eating. How did you get from spending the year in cooking school to writing the first book, which when it came out in America is called Land of Plenty, right? What happened that enabled you to do that?
Well, I spent a few months at the cooking school, and then I went back to England with the idea of doing a cookery book, because it just seemed crazy that you had this incredible cuisine that people didn't really know about in the West. So I had that sort of idea, and I did go back to the BBC for a bit, and then I went back to university and did a year of master's in Chinese studies, learning about the history and religion and culture of China. And while I was doing that, in between I sort of went back to China for long holidays. When I went on sort of going into kitchens and learning more about the food. And then when I went back to college, I started writing Chinese restaurant reviews for Time Out magazine in London. That was my first professional job.
There's the ultimate East meets West moment.
Yeah. And then I wrote a proposal for a Sichuanese cookery book, and I sent it to six publishers, and they all rejected it. And they said, Fuchsia, no one will be interested in the cuisine of one Chinese province, you know. So
I can so relate to this. There's so many times, you know, when I think I've had a great idea, and then you just meet resistance from all sides. And there's a moment that you either you keep going or you can just accept their judgment, right? I mean, what propelled you forward?
Well, I suppose that so I went back to the BBC doing a slightly different job there. And I was about to be sucked into sort of full-time work. And I thought, you know, I really want to write this book, so I'll give it one more go. So I spent quite a long time, maybe a couple of months, you know, rewriting a really good proposal, better than the first one. And then gave it to two publishers, and they both wanted it. And I didn't have an agent, so it was amazing sort of luck, really, that, you know, but... You know, a couple of publishers that were willing to take a punt on a sort of new idea, a regional Chinese cookbook, you know. And so then I signed a contract for that and then kept going back to Sichuan to do more research. And yeah.
And did you feel the need to have it vetted by any of the cooks or people you met in Sichuan province? Or did you, at that point, did you feel confident enough that you were good?
Well, it wasn't really a question of vetting, but I did want to try and get things right. And at that point, this is before email, when it was too expensive calling China. So what I would do is I would be testing recipes and researching, and I would come up with a whole lot of questions and issues, and I would write them all down. And then I would go back to China, and I would go and meet up with some chefs I knew and just ask them for their help with all these questions. So, so it wasn't exactly vetted, but I did really try to get things written accurately. And cooked accurately.
And did they welcome your questions?
Yeah. I mean, I've just been very lucky to have... I think people were quite touched that, you know, a Western woman and a university graduate was so crazy about their food. And they were very welcoming. I was treated with extraordinary kindness by sort of chefs and restaurateurs and, you know, food journalists and my old teachers who were absolutely... I mean, you know, nothing I do would be possible without the generous support and encouragement of all these people in China. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And what about when the book came out? Was there a certain amount of pride and no hostility or defensiveness or like, how can she do this?
No, people were very, I think they were quite proud. And also they'd all sort of taken a chance and, you know, investing all this time and effort in this crazy English woman who just said, I want to, you know, write a book about Sichuanese food. And then here was the actual book. And I think what happened after that was that, you know, a lot of foreign journalists started using my book as a sort of entry into Sichuanese cuisine. And they had people from the West and also from like Korea, I heard, you know, going to Sichuan with my book as a guide. And so I think they, you know, people felt that it was actually helping them to get the message across. Because, I mean, I was working with very talented people in China, but who didn't have good English. So they didn't really have a way to express the beauty and the you know, complexity of what they were doing.
In retrospect, how did you think you managed to crack the code when it comes to Chinese food and Chinese culture in a way that nobody had? You didn't have any forebearers, right? You didn't have any role models. You were totally, I don't hope you don't mind me saying this, Fuchsia, you were making it up as you went along.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, well, what can I say? I mean, I was just interested and very passionate about something that I thought people in the West should know more about. And so I've always written since I was quite young. And so I just did. I mean, it wasn't really a sort of such a conscious thing.
You were just following your passion.
Yeah.
And your curiosity. I mean, you're incredibly, I mean, and you're an intrepid adventurer, I might add. And I think all those things combine to allow you to crack the code.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say I don't feel like I've cracked a code. I mean, I'm just having a go at something, which is very fascinating, and trying to find ways to express things in English that are not, where it's not always obvious because there hasn't always been a vocabulary. So you're sort of trying to find new ways of describing things mm-hmm. that make them accessible.
And is that part of the appeal then, is trying to come up with a way to translate those things into English, like feelings and ingredients and a point of view that hadn't been previously expressed?
I think for any, you know, for any sort of food writer, that the thrill of being able to write about things that haven't been written about in your language very much. So there's been this, I think with China, it's not just with food writing. A lot of my friends of that era have been able to do quite pioneering things just because of that moment of China opening up and suddenly there being, you know, this sort of new interface between cultures.
Did you meet any skepticism from the Western press when you published Land of Plenty? You know, you're not Chinese, you know, how can you do this? Or was it, wow, this is really cool, someone embarked on this amazing adventure?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the time it was very well received. And I think now people are more sort of skeptical. There's this whole debate about cultural appropriation and things. But at the time, you have to remember that there was really quite very little information about China. It wasn't, you know, most people didn't go to China on holiday. There weren't so many Chinese people, you know, touring and visiting the West. They weren't as conspicuous, really, in the West for people. And so it was, I think, for a lot of people, Chinese culture felt quite inaccessible, you know? So it was just that particular time that I think people in the West were quite interested to have someone speaking their language being a kind of guide to something that they were interested in but didn't really have a way of accessing.
Yeah, and at that point, I guess the people who'd emigrated to England or the U.S., first of all, those migrations had happened a long time ago, right? Because China was quite closed for a long, long time. And they were so busy assimilating that there was no issue of cultural appropriation, right? Because that wasn't what they were worried about.
Yeah. But I think also, I mean, if you think, there have been great writers about Italian cuisine, about French cuisine, writing in English, but Moroccan. So it's not that it's, you know, there weren't people writing about, you know, foreign cuisines. There always have been, really.
It was just a thrill of discovery on the part of the reader, not just you.
Yeah, and I just think that, you know, China has this extraordinary gastronomic culture and it's very, very developed and very sophisticated. And there are, you know, really sort of minute and detailed and nuanced appreciation of flavor and texture, approach to cooking methods, the control of heat. And it's just that, you know, you need to do it justice in English to understand the sophistication of what people are doing. And if you think that, you know, most of the Chinese cooks and waiters working in Chinese restaurants, certainly at that time, you know, didn't really have the English to express things. So people, you know, you'd get Westerners, even if they were curious about food, going into Chinese restaurants, and there would be a language issue, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, for sure. So you then wrote The Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook, which was about Hunan province, which is where Mao was from. Is it safe to say that when you were writing that book, a lot of the philosophical and moral conflicts that come up when you think about China and its politics and its history started to sort of smack you in the face in a way that maybe they didn't before? Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had this idea that I wanted to write a cookbook in which recipes were interwoven with stories about Chinese revolutionary history, a lot of which is very difficult and troubled and things. So, of course, there was that. And also, personally, I mean, Sichuan was such a happy and idyllic, crazy time. And then I just launched myself. I mean, I just arrived in Hunan with a few phone numbers on pieces of paper and I'd arranged to rent an apartment through a friend of a friend. But I'd never been there. I didn't know anyone there. So it was another complete leap in the dark. And it was very difficult because I'd thought, oh, well, you know, I've been around Sichuan for 6 years or whatever it was. So this is just another province. But actually, it was almost like another country, another dialect, completely different character, different cuisine. So when I was first there, it was a very lonely and difficult time. The weather was terrible, didn't know anyone, didn't understand the local dialect. And then there was the SARS epidemic, this sort of new kind of pneumonia. And it was a very scary epidemic. And there were people dying in other parts of China. And all the other Westerners living in Changsha left. But I really wanted to do this book. And so I stayed there. And so it was tough. And I really... you know, I just did consider just giving it all up and going home. But
I bet your mother was encouraging you to come home.
They were a little worried. They were.
I could see that.
They were a little worried that suddenly, you know, because what would have happened if the SARS there'd been an outbreak where I was, then all the exit routes would have been closed and I would have been stuck there in quarantine. But I kind of took that risk. But the main thing that happened was that I met this wonderful couple, Liu Wei and San San, to whom the book was eventually dedicated. And through them, I met this very fascinating and wonderful circle of interesting people in Hunan. And I began to meet chefs there and other people in the food world.
So you felt like you might have been back in Chengdu in that way.
Well, not quite. But it was very lovely. And I just sort of... you know, had many amazing experiences there and made great friends who remain very good friends. And so it turned out to be a very rewarding experience, but it was difficult.
Did you start to think about what in fact had happened during the Cultural Revolution and during Mao's time? Because there's a lot of awful ugliness that took place. And were people free to speak about it? And how did you reconcile that with your experiences in China?
Well, I mean, people were and weren't able to talk about it. I mean, things would come out. I would learn a bit about, you know, this period. But I suppose it was just the case that everyone over a certain age, everyone of that generation had very difficult, traumatic experiences because of the upheavals of war and revolution. So it was very much kind of in the recent background. And I don't know. I mean, I suppose that, you know, it was very interesting. It was very touching. It was very sad in some ways to learn about it. But, you know, it's just part of the experience of China of the 20th century, you know, a sort of country which just went through extraordinary period of change with, you know, lots of trauma and violence and difficulty. And, you know, in the 90s, we're sort of coming out of that and finding a new place in the world and becoming more open. And, so it was just, it's been a very interesting period to be involved in China.
Then you wrote Shark's Fin and Sichuan Pepper, A Sweet Sour Memoir of Eating in China, which is a remarkable book, by the way. And I reread it knowing that I was going to talk to you. And I was just struck by the kaleidoscope of feelings that you were trying to reconcile. Like, talk a little bit about like why you decided to write a memoir and what went into it. There must have been, you know, people talk about, you know, I'm writing a memoir now and it's like people say, oh, it's going to be really therapeutic. But part of therapy is pain, you know, and suffering, you know. And so talk a little bit about that, like how the process came to – how the book came to be and what the process was like for you.
Well, I suppose that you know, there was a lot more that I wanted to say about China and Chinese cuisine and my experience of learning about it than I could really put in a cookery book. And I think that most cookery books at some level are a sort of romanticized, idealized picture of a place. You know, you want to whet people's appetites. You want to make them fall in love with it and show them the best of a place. And there were things I wanted to talk about that were more sort of complicated, like pollution and politics and my own sort of feelings of adjustment to another culture and the ups and downs of that. And also there was this whole thing, you know, being the first Westerner to train as a chef in a Chinese cooking school, which was, you know, people always seem to be very interested to hear about that. So I thought it would be interesting to write about it. Yeah, that's really, I think that's why I wanted to write the book. And it was, you know, writing about those golden days of Sichuan was lovely and, you know, quite moving, remembering all these markets and restaurants. And actually, it's quite lovely because some of my classmates from that period at Chengdu, they love the fact that I've recorded this period of life in Chengdu. But then there were the sort of, you know, the tough times in Hunan. And then while I was writing the book, I also had a kind of China crisis because I was sort of wondering whether I was, you know, getting tired of this, you know, itinerant life of all the time away from home and launching myself into new places. And, you know, it's just sort of, it's very fascinating, but sometimes it's lonely and sometimes it's difficult. And so I was kind of wondering whether I really wanted to go on with it or whether it was time to sort of give it up. And then also I was just, you know, it had been very sad to see the demolition of the old city of Chengdu almost in its entirety. You know, China's rapid development, there was this sort of destruction of a lot of rather wonderful, you know, vernacular architecture, tea houses, restaurants and things. And also pollution was becoming more of a worry. And I just sort of went through this phase of, you know, being tired of constantly negotiating another culture, constantly traveling and so on. And then while I was writing it, there was a point when, you know, I really was thinking of giving up China, doing something else, and then giving up the book. It was very tough writing a narrative book as well. And then something happened when I went to visit the old city of Yangzhou, which I wrote about. In fact, the final chapter of the book, I think, that I sort of found a second wind. And I went to this city of Yangzhou, which is in the region near Shanghai, the Jiangnan region. And
which you write about in the new book.
Yeah. And it was a rather lovely city, which reminded me in some ways of the Chengdu that I'd first fallen in love with. And I went there and I met some very interesting food experts and chefs, and just kind of, it just softened me up again and I just fell in love with it again.
Yeah.
So it was a sort of turning point, luckily for my career. But also it's really funny actually now, because now talking about it, that, you know, I'm totally into it again. I mean, I'm just fascinated. Yeah. And I did go through this period of, you know, a couple of years or more when I was just sort of weary.
Rereading the memoir, you also were confronting this notion of corruption and inequality, you know, like the disparity between people not having enough to eat and these grand banquets. And there are a lot of complex issues that you were facing and trying to make sense of, I think, I assume that those sowed the seeds of doubt.
Yeah, and I think also it's just that, you know, when you're young and crazy and with a lot of young friends having a hoot, having a really fun time and having all these crazy adventures, that's one thing. And it's like it's very sort of innocent. But the more you get to know a place, the more you get to understand its complexities, and the more, you know, the more you're affected sort of personally and emotionally by, you know, what the country is really about, and not just a sort of idealized playground for, you know, young students, whatever it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, let's face it, you were in China at a time of great change, and you saw the change wreak havoc and create opportunities at the same time. And it's a very complex stew. It's much like Sichuan cooking, you know, in that way. And I think it's kind of great that you did have this experience, quite lucky, right, as you say, because you might have given it all up, and then we'd all would have been really sad, Fuchsia, if there was no more Fuchsia Dunlop writing about Chinese food and Chinese culture. The world wouldn't be as rich a place. No, it's true. You know, it's just so interesting to me that you were dealing with a series of collisions in your head and in your heart. You know, it's like of conflicting feelings, and that, but you end up in a place where you can reconcile everything that you've experienced and seen and still come out with, you know, being in love with Chinese culture.
Yeah, and also kind of in a way more committed. I mean, I really do think that Chinese gastronomy and Chinese cuisine is both an amazing sort of creation as culture and as, in you know, expression of human creativity and inventiveness and so on. But it also has many important lessons for everyone in terms of health. Like, there's no other cuisine, perhaps, that combines pleasure and notions of health and balance like Chinese when it comes to food. And that's something that, you know, in the West, in the whole world, we're struggling with. You know, how do you eat well in a way that's both pleasurable and also, you know, good for health and environmentally sustainable? And I think we can find many of the answers and solutions in traditional Chinese cuisine.
Which is fascinating. It's that the world has come around to see that, and that we're all grappling with this, whether it's in America or England or France or Italy. That is, you know, the ultimate question for all of us who are interested in food as pleasure and understanding that it also does play a role, a big role in our health.
Yeah. I mean, I had a very interesting experience. I went with a Chinese friend to a very famous restaurant in Britain, and we had an extraordinary feast, you know, a tasting menu of quite dazzling complexity and deliciousness. And anyway, we had so many courses. And at the end of the meal, my Chinese friend said to me, you know, this has all been so delicious and wonderful, but I'm really feeling kind of bloated and heavy because we've ended up with this whole sequence of sort of sweet, heavy dishes, as you do with a Western sort of tasting menu. She said, if this was a Chinese banquet, even if we'd had 40 courses, you know, we would have ended up with a light soup with some fruit. And the purpose of the meal would have been to take us at the end to a place of physical comfort. We would be feeling very shufu, very well and comfortable.
What's it? Shufu?
Shufu means well or
shufu.
Comfortable. Yes.
Got it.
Yeah, and it's true. It's just with Chinese food, it's always concerned with the comfort of the body. And so just for example, you know, if you eat fried rice in China or fried noodles, okay, everyone likes them, they're very delicious, but you'll almost always be served with a bowl of broth. Because if you just eat the fried food, then it's very drying and heating, and you want something to refresh the palate. If you have rich dishes, you'll always have a light vegetable on the side or a soup. And so there's always this balance, and that's something that's really often missing in most Western cuisines.
Future, I've been so busy grilling you about so many other things. We haven't had a chance to talk about Land of Fish and Rice, which is your new book, and also how non-Chinese people can cook Chinese food at home, which I have many questions for you about. So would you come back?
I'd be delighted.
People should pick up a copy of Land of Fish and Rice, but also don't forget Shark's Fin and Sichuan Pepper, a sweet-sour memoir of eating in China. It's one of the great food-centric memoirs I've ever read. So thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming on Special Sauce.
Thank you very much.
This episode of Special Sauce has been brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company, publisher of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, the first book by resident Serious Eats pastry wizard Stella Parks. The recipes in Brave Tart are awesome, original, and rigorously tested. That's why they really do work. Plus, Stella is so smart, so curious, and such a good writer, you can happily read Brave Tart from cover to cover. I have, like it wasn't a cookbook. It's equal parts science, history, and sweets mythology explained and debunked. I know what you're thinking. As a Serious Eats overlord, I'm hopelessly biased when it comes to Stella. And I probably am. But you too will think she's swell when you get your own copy of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, wherever books are sold. We'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.